The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So I was away last week teaching retreat, and I think the week before we were talking about working with what you might call afflictive emotions or difficult emotions. And there's a little bit more that I'd like to go into about that, and then see if there's any discussion or practice questions that you have about working with difficult emotions. So one of the things that we sometimes feel, or we have this view, this belief, that our meditation practice, while we do learn and work with difficult emotions, we sometimes feel like our meditation practice doesn't really start until those emotions have settled down and we've gotten really calm and quiet. So that can be a kind of a view or a belief that we can't really see really deeply when all of these emotions are coming up. So I'd like to talk about that a little bit, because one thing that I've really understood and learned in my time of practice is that it doesn't matter what we are mindful of. Mindfulness is being cultivated, and we can really clearly, deeply see into the truths of our experience, no matter what we're paying attention to. It really doesn't matter. What does matter, though, is the quality of the mind that is observing the experience. And so with things like difficult emotions, often difficult emotions color the way we see things. So if we are angry, then when we're looking at the world through an angry mind, it filters, it changes, it colors how we're seeing things. And so that way of paying attention, if we are angry and we're looking at the world, we probably tend to land on things that make us angry or see things that confirm the legitimacy of our anger. And that may be one of the reasons why we think we have to get rid of these states in order to really see clearly. But there's a way that we can see the emotion clearly. I may have used this analogy in this class sometime in the past. We can think of our emotions as kind of being like sunglasses. You know, we put on sunglasses and we're looking through these colored lenses of these sunglasses. And that coloring of the world is like a mind filled with some strong emotion, and then we're looking through that emotion, and things tend to confirm that emotion, or that we are how we pick things up in the world is skewed by that emotion. So it's as if we're looking through some kind of colored lens. And the first movement of the mindfulness practice is to begin to recognize that we are looking through that colored lens, so that we've got the anger in our minds, and we know anger is present. It may not be that we can really see things objectively, but at least we know that anger is present. There's that kind of a recognition that anger is present and may well be coloring our world. So just that recognition, you know, it's like you put on dark glasses and go inside and look around. It's like, well, why is everything so dark? You know, it's like, oh, right, I left on the sunglasses. Now you can still see things, and the knowing that you're seeing through the dark glasses kind of helps you to adjust in a way. And likewise, just the recognition that you have this strong emotion helps you to kind of moderate some of the way in which that emotion, or we could call it a view of that emotion, impacts how we see things. So knowing that we're angry, knowing that we have that quality in our mind, we may be able to recognize, that's why I'm seeing things in this way. So that movement begins to help, just to recognize that the anger is present, or just recognize that the strong emotion is present, whatever emotion it is. And then as we continue to practice, we gain skill in the mindfulness. And there's a way that through all of the techniques that we talked about last time, through turning to the body, beginning to investigate the emotion. I think I talked about the recognition, acceptance, investigation, non-identification, the RAIN teaching last time. Did I go over that? I think I did. I'll remind you. So in terms of tools for working with emotions, there's an acronym that one of my teachers, Michelle McDonald, offered that supports our remembering these tools. And the tools are recognition, which is just that simple acknowledgement of what is happening. So this emotion is happening. Fear is happening. Anger is happening. Worry is happening. Anxiety is happening. Or happiness or joy or whatever emotion it is. Just the recognition. So recognition is the first aspect of that acronym RAIN, R-A-I-N. The second is acceptance, that we accept what's going on. We don't try to get rid of it with aversion. It's a much gentler approach, this practice of bringing mindfulness to our emotions. It's not an aversive, try to get rid of approach. It fundamentally works in a way through the acceptance. Now, it's an acceptance which isn't an acceptance that we act out on. It's an acceptance of the feeling. So that we're not trying to repress the feeling or get rid of the feeling. We're allowing. Another word might be allowing. Allowing the feelings of the emotions. Not trying to push them down, but we're also not acting on them. So this is kind of the middle, one of the ways in which this teaching points to the middle path. We, in acknowledging our emotions, we neither repress them nor do we act on them. We allow them to be present and we feel them. Then there's the third aspect of this acronym, investigation or interest. And this is where we turn towards the emotion, turn towards our experience. Typically, in our world of emotional life, when we have something strong emotionally happening, we are really focused out in the world on what we think is causing that emotion. So we're focused outward on that person or that situation, and how can we fix or change that person or situation, or how can we get ourselves out of the situation? So there's this orientation to looking outwards when we have a strong emotion, an orientation to how can I fix this emotion by fixing the world? And that the movement in our mindfulness practice is, rather than looking at the world instead of trying to figure out how do we change the world so we're not feeling this thing, we turn and look at ourselves. Ultimately, the reasons, the causes of the emotion lie within our own minds. There are situations in the world which trigger us to feel certain ways. But I mean, you can kind of, in just a reflection on this, see and understand that there's kind of a history that you've brought to a situation, and the situation, and those two things meet. And because of those two things, within our minds, there may be a reaction to that situation. Somebody else with a different history may come into that same situation and not have a reaction. So the reactivity has to do with the kind of confluence of events, both external and internal. And since often we can't control the external world, it's really helpful to turn towards the internal world and see what is happening inside. What is it that I'm responding to, that I'm reacting to internally? So perhaps as a child, you weren't seen by your parents terribly well, that they were always busy off doing their work and didn't spend a lot of time actually meeting you. And so you go through your life really strongly reactive when somebody is not seeing you, acknowledging you. So there's, you know, both sides of the situation contribute. And we ultimately have the most input over how our own minds are responding. And the first movement of that is to turn and learn and understand how our minds are responding in a given situation. So we turn to our experience and investigate. This is this third aspect, investigation. So we investigate what's going on. What's going on in our bodies? How do our bodies feel? We may recognize that there's some thought patterns that are going. We probably recognize there's a certain mood or tone in the mind. These three aspects of the thoughts, the mood or tone in the mind, and the feeling in the body are kind of the three parts that make up emotion. And we can be mindful of any of them. The attempt to be mindful of thoughts generally it can be challenging. And so it's often really helpful because our emotions have learned in a way that a really good way to get our attention is to kind of scream at us or, you know, produce these thoughts that are very repetitive. Pay attention to me, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. That's kind of like what our thoughts are doing when we have a strong emotion. I'm really angry. He shouldn't have done that. She shouldn't have said that. Our minds kind of spin that way. And that's in a way we recognize our emotions sometimes because of what the minds are saying. And that's one of the things we talked about the first week when we talked about recognizing emotions, getting familiar with the stories that our emotions generate. But when we pay attention to the thoughts, often they spiral out of control. We can be mindful of thinking, but often the best movement with emotions, with strong emotions in particular, is to let go of the thoughts. We can kind of think of the thoughts as being the flags that the emotion is throwing up. Okay, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. But typically we've learned what our habit is to pay attention through thinking about it, through through thinking about what we could do or should do or what they should have done or how we can fix this or change this. So we tend to try to figure our emotions out and pay attention to our emotions through the world of our thoughts. If we think about it long enough or hard enough, we'll figure it out. And that tends to feed the emotion rather than dissipating it. So the movement is to see, can you let go of the thoughts, let go of those flags, and turn towards the feeling itself, towards the feeling in the body, towards the feeling in the mind. And the feeling in the mind is pretty subtle at times. It can be hard to just hang out with that feeling, but the feeling in the body can be pretty grounding. If you turn to what is the emotional, the impact of that emotion on the body, there's, particularly with strong emotions, there's usually something present, something obvious. So turning to that, that's a way of acknowledging the emotion without feeding it. Because the thoughts tend to be the nourishment for the emotion. That's the fuel. And when we let go of the thoughts and come into the experience of the emotion, we're no longer fueling it, but we're allowing it. So again, that's that kind of middle path. We're not putting more fuel on the fire of that emotion. We're not repressing it. And we're also attending to it. So that movement to turn towards that's probably the biggest tool in our mindfulness toolbox for working with emotions. You'll notice at times in turning towards it that the thoughts begin again. See if you can just let them go and just come back, turning towards the feeling. And that in that turning towards, sometimes, not all the times, sometimes the emotion, because partly what it is that these strong emotions, these afflictive emotions or reactive emotions, we might call them, they want our attention. And when they get it in this way of mindful attention, they sometimes stop producing those thoughts. Not all the time, but sometimes. And so it settles the mind down sometimes to turn towards the feeling of the emotion. So that's recognition, acceptance, investigation. Non-identification is the last aspect of this. And this one is a little more challenging because we do strongly identify with our reactive emotions. Sometimes they are kind of who we think we are, or you know, in a sense, these reactive emotions are such familiar patterns that, you know, it's kind of like we drop into a groove. It's like, yep, that's me. I'm familiar with that. So we identify with them. Sometimes in a negative way, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm angry all the time, but I sure don't like this. I don't want this. I want to get rid of it. Sometimes we identify with something like self-righteousness, feeling like in a positive way. It's like, you know, that, yes, I'm right. So the identification can be very strong with these strong emotions. And the tools of recognition, acceptance, investigation support a little bit of a loosening of the grip of the identification that we have. And then there's a few tools that we can use in the realm of non-identification. One, I mean, just being the reflection, bringing in a reflection. This is just a visitor. The way of actually recognizing the emotion can support this non-identification. So for instance, you could recognize the emotion by saying to yourself, I'm angry. Or you could recognize the emotion by saying to yourself, anger is arising, or anger is happening. Just turning that, the language of how you acknowledge it, from being I'm such and such to being this is just something that's happening. And that's a pretty big shift, actually, to phrase it to yourself in that way. So that actually the non-identification piece, when we can experience an emotion and not be identified with it, that's as if we have taken the sunglasses off and are now looking at them instead of through them. So that there's not an identification. The identification with it is kind of when we're looking through it. But when we take the sunglasses off, we can look at them instead of through them. So there's a little bit of a sense of a distance. And it's that movement of non-identification that gives that a little bit of a distance. So the awareness, the mind of knowing, can know that emotion and not be identified with it. And so it gives a little bit of a, it's like a clean mirror looking at something. I'll go back to my mirror analogy. I'm sure I've used that in here before, but it's helpful, you know, if we think of the knowing as a mirror, as the quality of a mirror that reflects. The mirror can reflect anything. It doesn't care what's out there. The reflecting power of the mirror is unchanged by what it is reflecting. And likewise, the knowing power of our minds is not changed by what it knows. So the mind knows, the mind can know anything. It can know beautiful emotions, it can know challenging emotions, and it can simply reflect them. Just reflecting, anger is arising. Here's what it feels like when anger is arising. So that movement, you know, to take off the glasses, that's kind of the movement of non-identification. And with that non-identification, then that in turn supports our ability to recognize, accept or allow, and investigate. So they feed each other, these tools of recognition, acceptance, and investigation, and non-identification. And one more thing I'll say, and then I'd like to open it up for some discussion. In the process of observing, investigating, accepting, allowing our emotions, we learn a lot. So we learn what triggers us. We learn how our minds clamp down and tell its stories. So we learn a lot about how these emotions get created. We may learn something about the history that we've brought to the experience. Now, all of this, the real encouragement is to look in the present moment. There's a tendency, I think, with emotions to look back into history. Say, why am I this way? To think about our childhood, you know, especially with patterns, with strong patterns of emotions. We want to look back into our history and figure out why we are the way we were and think about it. And we have a tendency to want to think about it. And what I'd like to suggest that all the information that you need to understand your emotions and your responses is here in the present moment. And that just meeting it here in the present moment kind of begins to reveal the layers of how we cling, what triggers us, and sometimes it can also reveal the history So, for instance, you might be paying attention to a strong emotion that's been triggered in a situation at work, for instance. You know, and you're after work, you're still feeling that strong emotion, and you're just paying attention to it, just noticing the strong feeling. And while you're paying attention to it, you might recognize an image that pops into your mind about a time when you were a child. And that image has a kind of a connection with the situation at work. And you kind of get a sense of, oh yeah, that is the connection. You know, that thing that happened in my childhood happened over and over and over again. And that's why I'm so responsive and reactive to this situation here and now. So the investigation here and now can begin to reveal some of the history. But it's actually not necessary. It's not necessary. But it can be helpful, you know, that kind of recognition of history. At least in my own experience, the recognition of, from observing in the present moment, a real clear understanding of how my history came into play. It's kind of like, I see that the history is kind of coming into play here and now. And that's why the reaction is happening. That's what I would call a psychological insight, you know, that we see how our history comes into play in a way. It's also got the seeds of a what we can call a meditative insight, perhaps, because it's pointing to how causes and conditions create our experience. So we're getting an insight a little bit into cause and effect and nature of our experience. And as we start to see the cause and effect nature of our experience, it really supports that non-identification. Because we see, wow, you know, in my own experience, it's like, wow, you know, this is all just causes and conditions coming into play that create this response. And for me, it made it much easier then to not identify with that strong feeling when it came back. So that kind of psychological insight with the seeds of the understanding of cause and effect is very supportive of allowing that feeling. So, you know, coming back to that, the A of rain, that with the understanding of the causes and conditions, there's an opening to the allowing, the accepting. And then we can be a little more in that acceptance. It's a little easier to get closer to that feeling. It's a little bit easier to really investigate from this perspective of a little bit of distance when there isn't that sense of, this is me having this feeling. Oh, this is just this feeling arising. So it's interesting, those psychological insights, you know, they can be pretty powerful. And I might have described this a couple of weeks ago. At one point, I was observing a pattern of self-hatred and had that kind of a psychological insight into the self-hatred. And it was such an opening, and there was such a heartfelt opening to the kind of pattern and the people involved in that pattern, that there was this strong feeling of compassion, not only for myself, but for the others who kind of participated in the causes and conditions that led to that self-hatred. And it was such an opening. It was like, wow. I felt like I'd really understood something about that pattern so deeply. And I assumed that that understanding would eliminate the pattern of self-hatred. And I was actually shocked when some days later it came back. There it is again.
It helps.
It helps in that, again, it helped. And what I really saw was that it helped, that deep insight, psychological insight, helped me to be present for it. I was no longer so afraid of the self-hatred. It no longer was so me. So the then we can really start to not be identified with it. And we're really looking at it from this perspective of just the mirror reflecting the experience. And when we can get to that place of just the reflecting capacity of the mind with an emotion coming up, at that point, it really doesn't matter whether it's self-hatred or pressure on your butt or a sound. It's just phenomena arising in your experience and being known. And as we can meet those phenomena, we begin to see their impermanent nature, their unsatisfactory nature in terms of being a lasting source of happiness, whether to hold on to it or get rid of it. I mean, with the self-hatred example, it would be more like, well, if we could only get rid of this self-hatred, then I would be happy. Getting rid of anything is not... not a lasting source of happiness either. There's just something else that we'll have to get rid of. So that recognition of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and the not self, that this thing that's happening is not caused by me, it's not mine, and it's not who I am. It's just a process of, back to causes and conditions, that have come into play to create some phenomenon, whether self-hatred or a sight. And so that was my own experience, that further on in this retreat, that I, after I'd had this psychological insight around self-hatred, I was just meeting that experience of self-hatred. And at some point, really clearly seeing how it was put together in a split second in the mind through a thought and believing that thought. Like, you're no good. Boom, I believe that thought. And in that recognition of just like, wow, this is just a thought. You know, this is just process. That I would call a meditative insight, a kind of clear seeing into the ephemerality and the impermanence of that experience. And it was just constructed by causes and conditions. It was a deep seeing in the split second moment of its arising. It was seen to be just a thought and a response to that thought. And in that seeing, the pattern much more deeply began to let go. So the turning towards emotions, it takes some time, and it's kind of the process of using these tools begins to get us to the place where we can simply observe them without so much identification. And at that point, they're just the grist for the mill in terms of being able to understand things in their more fundamental nature, the more fundamental nature that everything is impermanent, everything is unsatisfactory as a place of lasting source of happiness, and nothing is me or mine or who I am. It's just a process. So I really encourage you to not have the view that if only I can get rid of this emotion, then I can have deep insight. The insight into our experience, both the kind of psychological insight and the meditative insight, which really begins to free us from our patterns. Those can happen right in the midst of, those insights can happen right in the midst of directly meeting our difficult emotions. So when difficult emotions are arising, they are the path towards freedom. When we turn towards them with wise mindfulness and wise understanding. So I've got more I can say, but I'm going to stop now. And but there's a mic on the floor. I'll repeat the question. Maybe we need a new battery for that one. Okay. Maybe the... Oh, good. Victor will help. So the question was, can we apply reflective practice to emotion, asking it questions, what purpose are you serving? What do you want? Absolutely. That's another way to investigate, in a way, that, not necessarily to act on what it wants.
Right, just
open it up a little more. And there's some, you can ask it, what purpose are you serving? What do you want? You can also, so you can ask it questions like that. You can also reflect in the way of bringing in some wisdom, like, this is nature. This is just a product of causes and conditions. This is nature for me tends to be a helpful reflection to bring in when I'm experiencing a strong emotion, because it does. It's just like, I think I used the analogy at some point of, our experience is kind of like the growing of a plant. It's just, there have been these conditions in the past that have come together, and then there's something coming in from the outside that it's like you've got this seed that's been planted, and it's, the seed itself isn't going to do anything unless all the conditions come together. It's got the soil, the nourishment, the water, the warmth, and then this tree grows. And it's kind of like that with emotions, that they come together as a result of all of these causes and conditions coming together. And for me, using that reflection, this is nature, kind of brings in that whole analogy and reminds me this is just a process. But definitely, are there other questions that people can think of that might support investigating the emotion? Anything else? Bud offered the what do you want?
Who are you?
But again, there's a way of engaging with these questions. I mean, basically that, not to think about it. So, dropping the question in kind of can open us up to some deeper things that are happening now, perhaps. It might open it up to that, 6-year-old that, really wanted to be seen. And then you can meet that energy, that feeling, again, with mindfulness, to just turn towards it. So are there any other? Yeah.
I like the alternative eye, I think you mentioned, which was interest, because I have a connotation that I put on investigation of I'm going to pin it down.
Yes. Okay, good. That's a good point, because the investigation is the word is kind, you're right. In our culture, it's got a figuring out quality to the word itself.
Mm-hmm.
So interest kind of more opens us up to what's here. It kind of settle back. Okay, what's actually already here? And that's a great model for that investigation. It's kind of like, I'll use another analogy. Just observing something that happens over and over again, you begin to understand its patterns without even really trying, you know, just by observing over and over again. At one point, a friend of mine and I took a walk through Foothills Park in Palo Alto. I think we did it every week for a couple of months, the same walk. And at some point, we started noticing the buckeye. You know the buckeyes, they're, you know, these things, and they fall to the ground. And at one point, we started noticing there are all these buckeyes all over the place. And then the next week, we noticed that they had a little taproot shooting out of them. And then the next week, we noticed that taproot was definitely seeking the ground. You know, it was growing around. If it came out on the top, it was growing around and going down. And then we watched the whole buckeye kind of turn, you know, and it got so that it got properly oriented in a way so that it could then start to sprout. So it's just like that meeting and being interested in that same thing, you know, coming through and kind of seeing, well, what's the pattern here? You know, what's going on? Not to try to figure it out, but just to meet, just to see. You know, and so there's kind of a little bit. I mean, I certainly don't know much about botany and buckeyes, but I did learn a little bit from that investigation, from that just meeting it over and over again. So just that kind of sense of being a naturalist, of just being interested in what's here, you know, what's actually here. Another analogy that I like to use that I think my Burmese teacher pointed this out, that investigation is like polishing a bowl with a soft cloth. It's just that meeting in a gentle way the experience so that you understand where the contact happens. You just meeting that outer. I mean, I can feel. In fact, you know, it's interesting. I can feel the ripples through the cloth here, so I can tell something about the structure of what the outside of this bell is like just through rubbing it. And that's what we're doing. We're just meeting the obvious aspects of our experience with investigation. He defined investigation as being rubbing. My Burmese teacher. It's just a rubbing. And in one retreat, apparently, he said, the translation came out something like, because he was encouraging people to pay attention to their breath at their abdomen, he said, rub your belly with your mind. That's how it came out in the translation. So just that kind of gentle... It's the contact. It's the staying in contact, and it's the softness of staying in contact that opens us up to more and more clarity of what's happening. We're not trying to take a pickaxe and pick it apart. That destroys, in a sense, what is here. So the quality of investigation is much more receptive. It's receptive, but it's interested. That interest, and the mind itself will begin to understand the patterns, begin to understand, for instance, how this series of things comes together to produce that reaction. And so we don't really have to figure it out. And actually, this is something that I like to reflect on myself because I'm such a great analyzer. I mean, that's been my training, you know, mathematician, computer scientist, to really dive into figuring out. Well, what I've discovered through the mindfulness practice is that there's kind of an inherent intuitive and analyzing process that goes on, that can really see and understand much more clearly than our own capacity to think and analyze, that the power of that natural analyzing capacity is way greater than our own intellectual analyzing capacity. So I like to reflect on that because I like analyzing. You know, I like understanding things. I like understanding how parts fit together and, you know, how it makes its things happen. But I've had to learn to really let go of that intentional intellectual analysis and let the analyzing process, the natural analyzing process, do its thing. It's really good at it. It's much... we're built in this, in a sense, to really understand how things work in our minds and bodies if we get out of the way. And so that's, for me, is a little bit of a carrot. It's like, okay, if I just, you know, okay, I think I can figure things out, but at the level at which we start seeing things in mindfulness practice, when the mindfulness starts getting really clear and continuous, it's picking up so much information, it's going much faster than our mind's power to think. The mind can really pick things up much more quickly than we can think about them. And so when we're thinking about them, we're way behind. We're way behind.
I wanted to mention one other thought, since we're on thinking. I think you said, I believe you said earlier that that the emotion, a strong emotion, precipitates a lot of thought, and I certainly have experienced that, but it's, I believe that the thought is what produces the emotion.
That it goes both ways, absolutely.
For example, last week when I was coming up here, I was in a merge lane, and I wanted to be treated fairly by the other drivers, and someone didn't seem to want to be fair in terms of alternating the two lanes. And I tried inching forward a couple of times, thinking the person would get that idea that it was going to alternate. That person didn't, and I laid on the horn and said a few things that I don't believe the other person heard because we were in two separate cars. But I was angry, and this morning as you were talking, it's very clear to me that kind of anger in me has to do with a sense that I'm not getting my fair share or my due,
yes,
from somebody else, and that I experience that kind of thought over and over again, when the truth from some interested and non-identification was it didn't matter who got in to the line ahead. It was only moving at 2 miles an hour anyhow.
Exactly. And that's a really important point around emotions, that thoughts both create emotion, and it's often not so much the thought itself, it's a reaction to a thought that creates the emotion. Because a thought can come up like, oh, fairness would be good here. And there can be that sense of, that fairness is important. You know, so there's that really kind of clinging on to it. So it's really helpful to see that as part of the process of thoughts coming into being. As you investigate thoughts, I mean, investigate emotions, you will probably discover that an emotion comes out of some arising of a thought. So, you know, for instance, you might be, you know, having a fine time, just, and there's because of an associative nature of thoughts, you know, you're having a fine time, you know, walking down a street and talking to a friend, and then you see this this tree that is the same kind of tree that you had an argument with a friend next to about this kind of tree. I mean, coming up with some silly example, you know, like, and that argument kind of really exploded. And then seeing this tree, the memory of that incident with your friend arises, and there is a reaction to that memory, and we're angry all over again. So that anger itself, sometimes with these strong patterns or habits, it doesn't take much to trigger them. You know, it's like they're pretty ingrained in a way in the mind, and so it just takes a fleeting little thought to send us into that pattern. But we can begin to watch that pattern happening. We can begin to see that, oh, there's a thought, there's a reaction, there's the emotion. Thought, reaction, emotion. Thought, reaction, emotion. And just seeing that over and over again, this is one of the ways in which the mindfulness kind of understands and learns, that kind of analysis. Thought, reaction, emotion. Thought, reaction, emotion. Thought, reaction, emotion. Not suffering, kind of suffering, really suffering. Not suffering, kind of suffering, really suffering. Over and over again, the mind sees that how the suffering is actually created, and it sees that reaction in the middle is kind of the linchpin that takes me from not suffering to suffering. And it starts to understand, oh, you know, if we can actually see that thought arising, we might start to see, oh, there's that kind of, ooh, I want to react. You know, that there's kind of these habits in our mind that they're so strong that even if they're unpleasant, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, angry, I'm going to, self-righteous, yeah, lonely, yeah, you know, it's kind of like our minds just have this directionality to them. And so when the mind starts to understand that directionality is something that it's doing to itself and that it results in suffering, it begins to let it go. So that process of observing how thought leads to emotion is really, really helpful. It's not so pleasant, you know, when we're first starting it, because what we get to see is thought, you know, we just kind of immediately explode. And it's like, oh, I don't want to feel this unpleasant, you know, don't want to feel this suffering. It's actually part of the process, that beginning to witness that. So starting to see, and I'm glad you noticed this, you know, you saw how it works. And continue that investigation. Yeah.
I'm assuming the anagram is RAIN.
Yes. Did I not say that? I'm sorry. RAIN.
I figured I could find one. Okay. Recognition, interest or investigation.
Acceptance.
Allowing. I liked allowing a little better than that. I like... recognition, allowing, investigation or interest, and non-identification. That is the huge thing for me. I have a person in my life that I see quite often in spiritual context, in meditation together, and I see that she's like a spiritual thermometer for me. How well I'm dealing with her and accepting whatever she triggers in me it tells me how well I'm doing. And
she's your non-identification thermometer.
Yes. Yes, but I'm discovering, and I have lots of people who agree with me about her.
That's a good trap.
It's a trap, just a really vicious. And so I'm beginning to see that I need to go through this process and understand or recognize the patterns in me, and they've been there for years and years and years. It's going to be a little work to do this, but I'm beginning to see her as a gift because of that. It's a mystery, isn't it? It's just like uncovering a mystery.
Yes, that's a great way to look at it, you know, kind of like, well, what's the mystery of this reaction?
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
So I just wanted to say, too, I was disappointed when you weren't here last week, but Jim did a great job.
Oh, good.
It was just great.
So I just have a comment.
Okay.
If I can remember it, it disappeared.
It was about the mystery, I think.
No, it was before the mystery.
Looking at the person triggered her as a gift.
The knowing a situation triggers you is a real gift because you can prepare. So you can, knowing that the meeting with her may trigger you, go into it with interest. Allow yourself to take interest in the whole process of, from the time you remember, oh yeah, I'm going to be seeing so-and-so tomorrow. Every time that comes up in your mind, what goes on in you? Is there a little bit of a tightening that happens, or a little bit of a thinking, oh, she's going to say that thing again? So allow that whole investigation to begin with the kind of knowing that you're going to be seeing her. So just exploring the whole pattern from the beginning. And then, what is the state of mind in which you are meeting her? Are there already ideas about how she's going to be? And I think some of that happens because we feel like we need to prepare and defend. And can we be recognizing that process and not be quite so closed to really just acknowledge the whole, and need to take care of yourself. I mean, you need to take care of yourself. If there's ways in which she's hurtful to you, you may want to take this exploration in small doses.
Yeah. I don't like the way I am when I'm with her. I don't like it at all.
Uh-huh. So that acknowledging that, but also acknowledging that perhaps there's some fear or some, self-protection going on that may, as you say, have a lot of history to it. You know, there's a lot of baggage to it. So starting with just investigating the surface, just that rubbing. Okay, so it's time to stop. So next week I'll talk a little bit about the other side of the emotional world, the world of the beautiful, the wholesome emotions that are kind of naturally cultivated as we work on this, as we engage in our practice. So thank you.